and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, a preview of the forthcoming 2014 Arctic Human Development Report. Scientists from across the North present their findings on sustainable human development in the circumpolar world. You'll hear from Gail Fondahl, Peter Schweitzer, Lee Husky, Gary Kofinas, Diane Hirschberg, and Andre Petrov. This panel was recorded at the UAA-APU Consortium Library on September 19th. It's been edited for broadcast. Gail Fondahl of the University of Northern British Columbia starts us off with an overview of the 2014 Arctic Human Development Report.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and I'd like to start off by recognizing our presence on Dena'ina land here. As was stated, I'll just give a quick overview of the report. And I want to put it into a historical context. The first circumpolar assessment of human development was done 10 years ago, Arctic Human Development Report. We're now starting to call it the first Arctic Human Development Report. And this was a project out of the Arctic Council. And what it did is it provided a baseline of human development in the Arctic. And it called for a updating of that from time to time. It didn't specify that. But it led to another set of projects, one project that had two phases. It was called the Arctic Social Indicators Project. And this was all about tracking and measuring human development in the Arctic. And the idea was that there are a lot of development indexes, including the most well-known one, the UN Human Development Index, but they don't really work all that well, or they don't work 100% well in the Arctic. So we need to develop some Arctic-specific measures of human development. And there were three areas that were specifically acknowledged in the first Arctic Human Development Report as important: closeness to nature, cultural viability, and control over one's fate, as things that were not measured in the Human Development Index. And so there was a three-year project in terms of developing some ways of measuring these indicators, of which many people in the room were involved, and another three-year project in terms of test driving them in six areas of the Arctic. And that continued on to the Arctic Human Development Report 2. And so it was about 2010 where we started talking about the need for a decadal revisiting of what was going on. And obviously, with the first one just being a baseline, you can't talk about trends and all that. We wanted to start looking at trends of human development in the Arctic. And so the Arctic Human Development Report, like I said, 2010, there was talk. It really got going in 2011. And several of us in this room have spent a good chunk of time in the last 3 years working on this. There are 27 lead authors. These authors were responsible for going out and getting contributing authors who had expertise in areas that they might not have. And then I also wanted to point out the target audience. In the first report, the target audience really was the policymakers and the Sustainable Development Working Group of the Arctic Council. What we found was, or what they found, because I was just not involved in that except for a tiny bit, was that UArctic and other educational institutions, and probably the University of Alaska Anchorage, picked this up and started using this. And they became as an important audience or a user as the policymakers. And so we have a bunch of different audiences that we're targeting this to. We've tried to write it in lay language, accessible. But the Sustainable Development Working Group of the Arctic Council is following this very closely and is calling it what they think will be a quote-unquote roadmap to prioritization of their activities coming down the pipeline. These are the objectives of the report. First of all, to provide an update to the 2004 report so we can start looking at trends. Obviously, the third human development report, which we all assume is going to happen, will be able to start doing a better job of that. To compare and contrast the cultural, economic, political, and social conditions in the Arctic. We're very interested in the both the physical and the social global change that has happened over the last 10 years. So there's been a lot of emphasis on climate change and environmental change. Globalization has been a huge issue too. And so we want to really underscore that as much as the physical change. So anyway, guiding questions, these were what we asked the authors to deal with. We asked them to look at how the Arctic differs from the outside world and also the heartlands of the Arctic states. How do these different identities, indigeneity, ethnicity, geography, not an identity, age, gender, affect experiences and the perceptions of change? What are the impacts of climate change? How much variance is there across the Arctic? And we are calling the report the Regional Processes and Global Connections. So we're really trying to focus on those two issues and trends and all that. And then we said to all the authors that we've got three cross-cutting themes. Gender, we wanted everyone to deal with gender, everyone to deal with climate change, environmental change, but climate change specifically, and everyone to deal with globalization. Even though there's a separate chapter on globalization, we felt it was really important to talk about globalization. So the report will be out late this fall. People have asked me exactly when. I can't tell you. There's been some slippage, but it has to be out in 2014 because it's a decadal reprise. And it's being published by the Nordic Council of Ministers, or Norden. And then coming from it will be a key findings document, which will provide the roadmap or the Coles notes to the roadmap for the Sustainable Development Working Group. And those will be presented at the October meeting of the SAOs that's coming up. And and then moving on from there, the report will probably, as far as I know, be launched at the ministerial, but I'm not quite sure about that. So that's my overview, and then we'll be hearing from about four chapters. So thank you.
The next speaker is Peter Schweitzer from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He's speaking on cultures and identities in the North.
So as Gail already mentioned, I'm one from the old guard, so one who already participated in the first Arctic Human Development Report. I will talk about some of the differences. Instead of kind of explaining in many words what culture is just this little kind of collage of images. You know, this is what you often refer to as high culture, you know, the arts, or in this particular case a new house of culture, so to say, in Reykjavik Harbor, that was just a couple of years ago opened to subsistence activities, like here reindeer herding, that are extremely important for culture and identity in the circumpolar north. These are kind of sacred sites here in the Russian north. You see sports, you see music, etc. So we have a very broad understanding of what culture and cultures are, and they are foundations for identities. And instead of showing lots of pictures, we threw on a number of different labels, because a big part of identities are the labels that come with them. And you know, just using the English language here, there's a lot of different identity labels that are being used in the North, native, non-native here in the Alaskan context, and this indigenous, non-indigenous division permeates a lot of the distinctions in the North. But there are also mixed identities, like Métis, for example, being used in the Canadian North. But there are also other divisions that point to subsistence difference, like the reindeer herding Sami and the non-reindeer herding Sami in Sweden, which makes a huge difference there in terms of identity and rights that come with it. Also, the settler, so-called settler population, so all the folks that are non-indigenous, is not a homogeneous group, and is often with different terminologies distinguished. The kind of the old settlers sometimes versus the newcomers. We start our chapter with an overview over colonial histories, or kind of a historical background, historical introduction to our topic, which we consider necessary. And again, this is just this represents four different areas of the North, from Yermak's campaign, so the Cossack commander in the 16th century who led a small troop of Cossacks across the Ural Mountains for the first time, which started the conquest of Siberia, to the the news about the signing of ANCSA here from the Tundra Times, which of course is an important, without understanding ANCSA, we cannot understand contemporary cultures and identities. We have the air base in Greenland, all that it has done, and all the protests that it has also fueled, clearly. Relocations that it triggered, et cetera, or the so-called DISC system among the Inuit of Canada. So very different aspects of the historical record that continue to be important today. If you talk about culture and cultures, there you can focus on a variety of different aspects of culture. We decided to focus on three main areas, and one of them is languages and language vitality. And as Gail already pointed out, that in a way it goes back not only to the first Arctic Human Development Report, but also to the Arctic Social Indicators reports, which repeatedly, which took up the message from the first Arctic Human Development Report that cultural vitality is critical. And at the same time, ASI then developed the notion that linguistic vitality, language retention, language vitality is a critical indicator for cultural vitality. This, for me, sums up the linguistic situation in the North. By and large, there is a decline of linguistic vitality, but there are some success stories. And it is really important to look at them closely to learn lessons from them. Often it has to do, not surprisingly, with the means. So often these success stories are in areas where there are more affluent indigenous communities that are able to invest money into that. But it's not money alone. It's the will of the people themselves to engage in learning and relearning the language. And another aspect of cultures, Arctic cultures, for us is spiritualities and worldviews. I'm going to skip that now because we also want to hear about other chapters. It's just as is the issue on arts and sports. And for me, this is a particularly kind of vibrant area. You have the whole range from very traditional arts and sports activities as represented in the in the World Eskimo Indian Olympics, to a Sami rock band here, and very contemporary Alaskan native art. I think in this area you see a lot of movement, a lot of dynamic, a lot of vitality, and I think that is positive. You also see an increase of the social value and the cultural value of these productions, something that you didn't see 20, 30 years ago. Talking about sports, and Doug already mentioned, I'm a fan of soccer. This is the small but successful Faroese soccer team. So, which by the way beat the national team of Austria. Rudy knows about that. And, for the small North Atlantic nation of the Faroes, soccer is one of the symbols of identity, which brings me to the other part of our chapter of identities. There are national identities, especially in areas such as the Faroes and Iceland, you have rather homogeneous national identities. In other parts of the North, it's more complex because it is often within in one country you have the contradistinction between the southerners and the northerners. More typically, on a very general scale, you have indigenous and settler population, but always, in reality, every country has a growing population of mixed people, biologically, culturally mixed. And that I think is one of the really interesting developments in the North. In some areas it's acknowledged, in other parts of the North it's not so much acknowledged because politics, identity politics is more on this duality between indigenous and non-indigenous, but realities. Then what I wanted to say here is that a big, you know, it's probably not really part of a chapter on culture, but it became very important for us in writing to point out the difficulties. You know, if you want to write about cultures and identities, you need numbers. You need numbers in terms of who declares himself, herself as belonging to which identity or belonging to which religious denomination. There are enormous issues with the statistics, so to say, of identity, which of course other chapters, such as the demography chapter, also point to. This point, second to the last, is this notion of you know, in the past, being in the Arctic meant that you were far away, not only geographically far away, but you were socially far away, you were marginalized. You see that more and more, definitely in the European Arctic, being northern is becoming, you getting more and more strategic advantage. I think you also see it in places like Alaska, you know, not only the growing awareness about the North, but the kind of the cultural and social prestige that comes along with it. What I really want to focus on now are the major developments of the last 10 years. Culture, you could say, or many aspects of culture, I would say, are slow moving variables. So, in a way, on some level, you could say there hasn't been a lot of change in the 10 years. So, a number of trends that we already saw in 2004 have continued. So, these two parallel and somewhat contradictory trends of increasing revitalization of primarily indigenous cultures and languages, and on the other hand, globalization, cultural globalization, that seems to be the opposite of that. In a way, these two things do not contradict each other. They are parallel processes, and we need to take note of that. Our chapter, like some of the other chapters in the report, repeatedly point out that fate control, so meaning having control on the local level about, you know, about language politics, for example, because that's such a central aspect of our chapter here, is critical. And this, you know, if you look at the case studies where things have been going well, fate control, local control is a critical aspect. So, about the similarities and differences between the North, I would say, you know, of course there are large similarities, but the major difference being that I think the North has a kind of the role of an avant-garde as indigenous identity politics is concerned, and also bringing up the value of culture. So kind of using culture as a tool, as a weapon in a globalizing world. And this is now the final slide where I have already mentioned a number of the things. Climate change, as Gail mentioned, all of the chapters were asked to address that. We can only say it is important in some areas, but let's not jump to a conclusion that climate change is important for cultures and identities everywhere in the North. There's a lot of variation from locality to locality in terms of what the people themselves say about the importance of climate change. And it would be a mistake to assume that climate change is the major threat to cultures and identities. We have mentioned that several times, that the growing global awareness has its benefits and challenges for the people who live in the Arctic, but culture is becoming that resource. It's not only oil and other non-renewable resources that are attractive, but I think more and more northern culture is becoming an asset that is being sought after by southern consumers. Thank you very much.
The next speaker is Lee Husky of the University of Alaska Anchorage, who's speaking on economies of the North.
The first decade of the 21st century is a period of relatively rapid growth in the monetary or the international or the modern economy, if you will, of the circumpolar North. But really, even though the rate of change was pretty dramatically different than it was in the first, when the first age, our first human development report was done, the economy hasn't changed much since that period of time. The surprising stuff about the Arctic economy is always when you take the Arctic as a region or the circumpolar North as a region, surprising thing, it's pretty big. Measured in terms of gross regional product, it's as big as countries. And during this period of time, one of the things that we found was the Arctic economy grew faster than the economies of the nations that contain the Arctic. And that was okay. What I wanted to do is just do is a quick overview of three things we were asked to do. What were the trends during that period of time? What did looking at this period of time tell us about what we expect to happen in the future? And then what are some questions that we have, some research questions that we have about the economy? One of the things that's true is in the first decade of the 21st century, the Arctic economy as a whole grew pretty dramatically. But that growth and that economic activity was concentrated. It was concentrated primarily in the Russian North and in Alaska. And even within each Arctic country, production was concentrated. So one of the lessons about the economy of the North is this was a decade of much growth, but the growth wasn't evenly spread throughout the countries of the Arctic or the Arctic regions of those countries. Two things that resulted in concentration are obvious things. One was the existence of resources. They're not evenly spread, so economic activity wasn't evenly spread. And then the existence of cities. And that's the thing that I think is interesting for the future. I think somebody mentioned that today. What role settlements will play in the future of the northern economy. One of the things that we worry a lot about when we talk about the economy of any region is how much of the rent or the production of the region stays in the region. So you can have a lot of production in Alaska. We always look at Kennecott, the Kennecott mine. There were a lot of production, but nothing stayed in Alaska. Everything left. That's one of the questions when we look at the Arctic. How much of this production stayed in the Arctic? Because there's lots of institutional reasons for that, for production, the rents that are generated by resource production to leave the region. Capital comes from outside, lots of labor comes from outside, national governments take rent away and taxes. And so we're interested in how does this growth in economic activity that took place in the first decade, how did that affect the people of the region? One measure of that, just a rough measure of whether this activity had any real positive effect on the population of the region is, does it look like people in the region got jobs from this economic activity? And one of the things we found that except for the Russian North, both population and employment growth grew, and the dependency rate increased only in Greenland and Iceland. So outside of Russia, all the other northern places, the dependency rate fell. The dependency rate is the number of people per job. And so if that rate's falling, it's at least possible that more people in the region are actually being employed. Of course, in the North, when we look at why the growth occurred, what we focus on is the importance of two sectors. That's the resource production, which was big, and the public sector. We know this from our long history of looking at the economy of the North, the two important sectors, the production of natural resources and the government sector. And those, of course, were important throughout the North. As this says here, those two sectors made up half of production in six of the eight Arctic nations. But even in terms of what was produced in these regions, there was real diversity there. And there's this kind of cool, interesting difference between the way the Nordic North, the European North, and the rest fell out. The Nordic North is less dependent on natural resource production and government. Okay, more different kinds of activities outside of those areas were important for those sectors of the North. I think you can summarize sort of what we found about the North by looking at what we concluded were some trends that we thought will take the North into the future, things to keep in mind. The Arctic, we believed, the Arctic is a high-cost region, and we don't see that changing. Now, let me just put this in a little context. I've lived in Alaska a long time, and one of the things you learn about when you live in the North is the hopeful language people use to talk about the economy. You know, it's the boom is always on, you know, on the horizon. And in the North, across the circumpolar North now, this is the language of economics. It's this hopeful language. And it comes from, in this first decade of the 21st century, it's built, the story is often built around climate change. You know, and you know, I don't have to, we can all say it, it's a mantra, right? Climate change is making access to resources in the North. This storehouse of resources we've always known is there. It's making those resources accessible. And so it's opening up the North. It's climate change that's opening up the North. And in a sense, that's implies in the future, resource production will continue because it will get, the climate change will make it cheaper to produce in the North. Well, that's maybe, you know, maybe some places, but probably not everywhere and probably not much of the region. I think climate change on the North Slope, we know that that increases the cost of production. It reduces the time that international energy companies have to spend on the land, okay, which increases their cost of development and exploration. So there are positive and negative effects of climate change. And so I think in the long run, we still have to worry about the Arctic as a high-cost region. Second trend that will affect the continued economic activity in the North is that the North, this was something that was pointed out in the first AHDR, there's been an institutional change in the North. More and more resource production decisions are profit-driven. Okay, there's a change. They're not strategy-driven so much anymore. They're profit-driven. And as we go forward, economic development in the North will be driven by profits. And one of the things that we have to remind ourselves of when we look at this first decade of the 21st century and the rapid increase in economic activity, this was a time of high resource prices. Okay, and part of the hopeful dialogue about the future is, of course, those high prices will continue forever. As an economist, I wouldn't make that bet. Resource prices have gone up and come back down historically. And so as resource prices return to Earth, that has an effect on economic activity. I think we saw that in many resource projects throughout the North that are put on hold or have been shut down as prices fell at the end of the first decade of the 21st century. I think in the future, and this number four here is, I think, where we, Nikolai talked about hope in the darkest times. This is, number four is where we hang our hope for the future in the economy of the North, and that's the increased privatization and localization of decision making. And by that I mean, one of the great trends throughout the North is increased ownership and decision making authority of people who live in the North. And then throughout the future, we can't forget, and this the chapter suggests the importance of these other sectors other than natural resource production for the market, and that's the traditional sector and the public and this non-resource sector. Three areas that we mentioned as places where we wish we had more knowledge or where we thought the opportunities for more for research to learn something was available was, first of all, in this area of innovations in local decision-making organizations. Let me explain this. Here's the link. We have these organizations, native claims, land claims, governments, that are more involved in making decisions about the use of local resources and claiming more of the rents from those production for local residents. We have, throughout the North, we've had this great natural experiment. There's all sorts of these kinds of organizations that make decisions differently, that share resources differently throughout the whole North. We have an opportunity to look across the North at this variety of ownership regimes, well, maybe ownerships in quotes regimes, and see what works and what doesn't work and how we can improve them. That's a gap in our knowledge that we could fill. Another thing that shows up is throughout the North, there are these non-natural resource, non-public sector activities that are taking place, whether it's finance, if you're anybody from Iceland might chuckle about this, but the whole financial experiment in Iceland didn't seem like a northern thing, but it was a northern thing, okay? And it took place in the North. The whole technology revolution that took place in Oulu, that's not a northern thing, it took place in the North. The growth of tourism, okay? So there's this that's where I was going with this, sorry about that. This stuff takes place in cities. And so one of the things that when we look to the future, we need to ask ourselves is how does cities change the economy of the North? And then last, one of the things that we've mentioned in the chapter is the continued importance of the traditional economy throughout the North, and it's an economy that we don't know much about, or at least we're not able to easily compare it to the modern or the international economy, because we can't measure it in terms of dollars. That may not even be the way you should do it. But we need to have a better understanding of which will allow us to compare the traditional and the modern sectors. Thanks.
You're listening to a preview of the forthcoming 2014 Arctic Human Development Report on Addressing Alaskans. Scientists present their work in the areas of culture and identity, economies of the North, and resource governance. This talk was recorded September 19th at the UAA APU Consortium Library. The next speaker is UAF's Gary Kofinas, who talks on resource governance.
As was mentioned, our chapter is on resource governance. I am the co-lead author with Bruce Forbes. We structured our chapter somewhat differently than the ones that have been described by having 9 different contributing authors, and I'll talk a little bit about how we engaged them in that process. The first Arctic Human Development Report talked a lot about property rights. It talked a lot about the need for co-management, and it gave a number of examples of how those were playing out, and issues of property rights and performance of power sharing between local communities and in management of commonly shared natural resources. As we looked ahead, we realized that one of the big issues in resource governance now has to do with this issue of the Arctic and Arctic resource governance being thrust into the global context. It's no longer a regional and somewhat esoteric event. And I've got the picture of the Russian flag being planted, being claiming non-renewable resource under the sea there. This global context has implications to climate change as well as we think about how a climate regime shift could have implications for the global climate as well. We also thought that we also realized that resource of non-renewable resource extraction had become much more of an issue, a challenge in resource governance than it had been back then. The demand for non-renewable resources in the North is greater than it ever has been. We also noted that the integration of knowledge is it's no longer a debate about whether or not we should see local and traditional knowledge as legitimate. Now the question is, how do we bring that together with this other system of knowledge? How do we integrate this and have a more holistic understanding? So those are just some of the starting points that we outline in the chapter. And the way we approached it is we described those in general terms, and we had case studies, which I will just describe very briefly. Really talking about informal relationships, community-to-community relationships across Alaska and Russia in management of walrus, and how a lot of work was being done to coordinate activities, to think about monitoring, to develop science agendas that didn't involve formal agreements. And it was a really terrific case study that talked about the Bering Strait and what was happening in this international arrangement. There was a case study on Nordic reindeer governance in the context of contemporary protected areas. This really focused quite a bit on Sweden and how while there were some property rights that afforded reindeer herders special use, that was often independent of land use planning activity. So there was a real disconnect and increasing pressure, which in some ways eroded the Sami people's rights, and a whole number of issues having to do with predators and charismatic megafauna and how that was being dealt with. Contrasting to that was a case study about Sami fishing rights and indigenous participation in Norwegian fisheries governance, where Sami fishing rights really had found a place within a multi-stakeholder setting and had been quite successful in meeting Sami needs. So it wasn't as if it was an exclusive right. It had been incorporated into a greater system and had seemed to be working pretty well with some warts and blemishes. We had a really interesting discussion about Greenland assuming responsibilities for extraction of and governance of non-renewable resources, and an effort to create a system of public participation where there was no history of that. There's the history of colonialism and Danish rule, and how there was this kind of clunky process of engaging the community, the citizens of that country in decision making, and how it had its share of problems. There was a case study about the transformation and restructuring of forestry with some examples of Sweden, some of the issues around trying to maintain and develop sustainable forestry practices. And finally, Oren Young and Paula Kopala gave us a case study on the role of the Arctic Council in resource governance, really highlighting how the authority of the powers of the Arctic Council are really limited. It's a recommending body. It facilitates. It doesn't make a lot of decisions. But in spite of that, they pointed out that there had been a number of successes contributing to resource governance in the North. And so those are the case studies. They're quick reads, and they're quite informative. And so across the board, we saw some trends, and one of them had to do with the complexity, an increasing complexity of resource governance, the number of players, the number of rules, the regimes. In some cases, that's a good thing if we think about this idea of polycentricity and how overlapping systems can create redundancy and really help a system be more resilient, but it also can create more conflict. There was greater acknowledgement of the cognitive rather than physical human land relations, and by that, there seems to be a greater acknowledgement in all of these case studies about how people relate to the land, and human environment relationships were described by in many of the case studies as being really critical. How we see the land and how we see nature seems to be real a very important part, and it's been highlighted as critical among indigenous peoples of the North. And also is an increasing adoption of best practices. So we're left with a few questions. Can the existing systems of resource governance keep pace with rapid change? It's a really big question. Are the institutions able to evolve, to be flexible enough and responsive enough, given the kind of changes that are likely to occur in the future? And what are the effects of all this need for responsiveness and greater demands on community involvement, where there's already limited funding, and there might be even that may be more stress in the future? And also environmental monitoring programs that are often underfunded, and how will that play out with limited funding? And finally, to what extent, this is where I started, to what extent the resource governance systems can facilitate social learning and innovation. So with that, it's all yours.
The next speakers are Diane Hirschberg, who is speaking on education in the North, followed by Andre Petrov, who will be speaking on human capital.
Hi, I'm Diane Hirschberg from the University of Alaska, Anchorage, and Andre Petrov from University of Northern Iowa will speak after me. And you'll see at the end of this, we do have a list of our contributing authors, and we really have quite a few, in part because, at least for me, one of the interesting things is the lack of a broad array of literature on Arctic education in English. And so instead of trying to figure this out myself, I actually went to the source and brought in a lot of authors from other nations, in particular indigenous authors, who helped frame a lot of the information that we ended up including in this chapter. And Gail gave a bit of an overview of what we've added, especially in terms of human capital, but we also did add a discussion about the importance of indigenous as well as Western epistemologies and ways of teaching and learning, and a brief discussion about informal processes for transferring knowledge, that education is not necessarily what we tend to think about with formal schooling, that it's much broader than that. Also looking at a shift in a conversation about the purpose of both formal and informal education, that's not just about workforce or further education, but also success in retaining cultures or being productive members of communities. And we really did, again, have a big emphasis on human capital development as part of this conversation on education. And so I'm gonna talk mostly about the K-12 education findings, and then Andre will talk about the post-secondary and human capital. And what's very consistent across the North, unfortunately, is some of the less positive news, and a lot of things that are very familiar to people in Alaska. First of all, other chapters talk about population migration and the fact that we have a lot of small rural communities that continue to decrease in size, and what goes along with that is schools closing. A lot of northern areas, especially the most small, the most remote communities, schools are closing, and when schools close, often communities are threatened. We've had 27 schools in Alaska close since 1998 due to declining numbers. And as of this past year, it looked like we were going to have more close. And there is an ongoing discussion about whether we can maintain the small size of schools, the minimum size. And it is an ongoing discussion across northern Russia and many other northern rural and remote communities. Schools across the North struggle with recruiting and retaining teachers. Those of you, again, in Anchorage would have seen in Sunday's paper a long article about this issue and the difficulties both in attracting teachers from outside because we're not preparing enough of our own local teachers from our rural and remote communities, and then the issue of keeping teachers once we get them here. Again, this is consistent whether you're looking across northern Canada or many other parts in northern Arctic Europe and in Russia. There's a lot of issues. We were talking about cultures and identities of non-indigenous, non-rural, urban people coming into our rural and remote communities and not succeeding, not so much because they're not good teachers, but because they're not prepared to be interacting with the cultures in those communities or to deal with the living conditions, which are quite different. And you saw referenced earlier that there is this interesting dual happening with languages, that there's both an increasing there's an increase in the attention to the need to preserve indigenous languages. Language revitalization is a big push. We've got language immersion schools. You've got Sami language schools. And yet, at the same time, we've got language loss. And what part of that is, it has to do with also who we get in as educators. So if you can't find educators who can actually teach in heritage languages, and also because a lot of families continue to want their students to learn in a Western language so that they can compete in the economy, we end up having ongoing problems with language loss. And then we have an achievement gap that is particularly problematic for Indigenous students. And you see some of the data here that in Nunavut, graduation rates are between 32 and 38% in a four-year period. Nunavik, slightly to the east there, fewer than one out of five students getting the equivalent of a high school diploma. And looking at the difference continuing between dropout rates for Indigenous and non-Indigenous students and graduation rates, where the graduation rate for Indigenous students in 2013 was 57% versus 70, almost 72% for all students. And once you separate this out for some of our more rural and remote communities, the data gets even more stark. At the same time, we have across the North communities that are moving toward creating educational models that are incorporating or based on traditional ways of teaching and learning. It's not just acknowledging cultures. We had a conversation this morning about, you know, ministries of culture looking at Indigenous people simply in terms of dance or arts. And now there's many places a deeper understanding of very different approaches to pedagogy. In Greenland, you have a system that has been struggling with the legacy of colonization and a Danish model of teaching and an intentional conversation and approach to a decolonized model of teaching, especially trying to help teachers understand the system they came through and how they can do things differently. We've got the North Slope Borough School District, which has developed the Inupiaq learning framework and is now going through a very extensive curriculum development process that both uses Alaska's content standards, which have been really enhanced and strengthened, but also uses the Inupiaq learning framework with the notion that you can teach children from within their culture and using Indigenous ways of teaching and learning and still have them excel and be able to compete in the Western economic and educational system. So in some places, these efforts are government driven. In other places, these efforts are happening despite the government. The gender gap, we talked about gender issues, and this continues, and in a lot of cases, people don't realize, but maybe in this room we do, that the gender gap often means that women are leaving men behind, in particular in education. And again, if you look at Nunavut, women graduated high school at a higher rate than men in all but 1 year. The high school graduation rates were relatively low, but you were seeing much higher rates for women than men. And again, in Alaska, the gap is considerable, in particular when you look at Indigenous or African American men and women in our state. Andre.
Okay, well, so the other part of this chapter is about human capital, and it's kind of new. Well, I guess it is a new component in the Arctic Human Development Report, and so I'll allow myself to have a few slides. So we devoted a little bit of time to explain why human capital should be a part of Human Development Report and how human development is framed by human capital, right? So of course we know that human capital in general is a major driver of modern economy, and it has a special role in the Arctic. And I think it's part of the argument of this new report that human investment in human capital, investment in people, is something that actually probably one of the ways to break away from resource dependency and allow growth and real development from within Arctic communities. So that's one of the kind of new arguments that we introduced. We looked at human capital and its traditional understanding as a capacities and knowledge through the formal education, but also we looked at other elements of human capital, such as creative capital, ability to innovate, create new things, whether they come from entrepreneurial component, they come from technical innovation, they come from culture. So that's the idea. And we argue that the role of education in economic well-being or other components of well-being, and again, education broadly defined, is very definitive in this 21st century, in this second report of the 21st century. So human capital, we defined as the stock of knowledge and skills embodied in human population that have economic value. That's very important. So this is deployable knowledge, knowledge that people utilize for economic benefit for themselves or their community, right? They could be subdivided in general skills, specific skills, and technical and scientific knowledge. And most of what we were analyzing is the higher levels of education, which is post-secondary education. There are certain things that I would like to highlight. First of all, increase of access to post-secondary education across the Arctic is quite substantial. Even in the last 10 years, we see that every major country, I guess every country except Canada in the Arctic has a university. Well, Canada, of course, has only Yukon College, Aurora College, and of course, other educational institutions that are not universities, but maybe soon. But still, we have growth and availability of education and investment in certain programs. Another component that we looked at is educational attainment. And educational attainment is a variable that is the most sort of straightforward and easy to collect, right? Because basically we look at people that achieved certain level of education. In this case, it's post-secondary education, so they have bachelor's degree or higher. And we see that, so the map on the left is the bachelor, the map on the right is a master's degree and up. We see that, you know, there is substantial variability. Russian North is looking pretty well. Scandinavian North is looking pretty well. However, of course, in the master's degrees, we see and that Canadian Alaska is doing okay. I mean, again, this is in comparison to other regions, right? When we compare with educational attainment in lower 48 or the southern Canada, that looks slightly different. However, still there are good news there as well. But still, I think the argument that we make is that Arctic has human capital. I mean, there is human capital in the Arctic. The big question is how we could deploy it to work locally, not fly in, fly out, not take this influx of human capital in and then immediately out. But how do we make sure that we have human capital that is in the Arctic, stays in the Arctic, and works for the Arctic, I think. So what are the major findings that we can report today? First of all, it's an increasing role of human capital and demand for human capital for economic well-being, fate control, and human development in general. That's very important. So the role of human capital is increasing and will be increasing because we live in an economy in which this is the major asset. At the same time, there are persistent gaps in human capital that related to gaps in education. Gap between Arctic and the southern regions, we still see that. Gap between urban and industrial Arctic regions and the rest of the Arctic. That's a quite stark difference between urban Arctic and non-urban Arctic. And we still see the gap between indigenous and non-indigenous population in terms of the formal schooling, right? And there are quite a telling numbers here from different regions. We were collecting this data from various parts of the Arctic. Persistent high school dropout rates, and Diane mentioned it, which propagates further, right? And so if you drop out of high school, you won't attain other levels of education, at least formal education. And that's, of course, one of the biggest problems. Another problem is a brain drain, right? The brain drain, whether it's before you attain the education or when you attain education, but also brain turnover, the one that I referred already, that people with education come to the North, but then they don't stay, they go away. So their brains are not invested locally, and that's exactly one of the biggest problems. And an interesting notion of brain waves, when people, you know, there is a large surge of educated people, and then they all leave when resource, for example, economy is going down. Still, we observed gains in post-secondary education, and both among indigenous people and among the rest of the Arctic population, which is a positive result, of course. Another interesting trend that has been observed before, but we confirm it and emphasize, it's a feminization of human capital. Women dominate the realm of education. Whether we're looking at enrollments in most Arctic universities or looking at educated people with bachelor's degree and up, the women are dominating, right? And that's, of course, very important. Another component that we also mentioned, and Diane referred to it already, that we have an improving relationship between formal and local indigenous knowledge and education, because we have this growing realization that both of them are important for building human capital in the Arctic. Both of these need to be integrated, right? And that's very promising as well. And that's a fairly new trend. So these are the list of our co-authors. And that is really what I think the most exciting part about this chapter, right? That it's not just Diane and I sit down in the office and type it up, but this is really a work of a lot of people. And I think it's interesting chapter because of that, and because it also, as I said, bring new things that HDR1 did not do. So with that, I guess I rest my case. Thank you.
After all the scientists presented their findings, Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell took the floor to offer reflections and further discussion on the forthcoming Arctic Human Development Report. For the full audio from this lecture, including Treadwell's comments, check out our website at alaskapublic.org. You've been listening to a preview of the 2014 Arctic Human Development Report on Addressing Alaskans. The scientists you heard from, in order, were Gail Fondahl, Peter Schweitzer, Lee Husky, Gary Kofinas, Diane Hirschberg, and Andrei Petrov. This panel was recorded at the UAA-APU Consortium Library on September 19th. It was hosted by UAA. Thanks for tuning in with us today on Addressing Alaskans. I'm your host and producer, Monica Goki.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.